Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Betsy and Wally Stern Conference Center here at the Hudson Institute. Thank you for joining us. I am John Walters. I'm Chief Operating Officer of the Hudson Institute. I'm standing in for Ambassador Jaime Derenbloom, who was to be the moderator of this session, but unfortunately, because of illness, is unable to join us. I know there are many of his friends here, both on the panel and in the audience, and probably watching from outside this room, who wish him well, and he is in our thoughts and prayers for a swift and full recovery. I also want to welcome our viewers on Ustream. Voice of America is here. There are a couple of offices of the U.S. military who've asked to watch this panel to better understand events in Venezuela. I want to welcome those people who are also serving the United States and making sacrifices for this country. We're all grateful for your service as well here at Hudson, and I'm sure in the audience as well. As you all know who are here, and many of you are watching, and Venezuela has been and continues to be a very important country, both in relations to the United States and in the Western Hemisphere. And part of that influence is also rendered outside the Western Hemisphere. We're trying to understand what is happening there and trying to make improvements on the situation. Before I came to Hudson, I served in the George W. Bush administration as director of drug control policy and had a portion of that responsibility directed toward events in Venezuela. At that time, circumstances were expanding drug trade through failure of the Chavez administration to take appropriate action, collusion with narco-terrorists and other global threats, ruining the economy of Venezuela and generally causing a catastrophe for public safety in Venezuela. I understand that since I left office, things have changed. They've gotten worse. So the recent election and the results of it are a puzzle to many people given the record and circumstances, and we're very pleased to have a knowledgeable panel here today to help explain not only those results, but also what's going to happen in the future and what are the prospects and possibilities. I'm going to introduce them briefly. They deserve much fuller introductions, and I'm going to trust you to use the bios that are provided at each place here in the conference center to read those. I'm in the interest of time and not taking away from their presentation. I'm just going to introduce them briefly. I'll introduce them in the order they will speak. They will then come up and make remarks. We'll have a couple of comments, questions afterwards, and then we'll open the floor up for questions from the audience. If you want to send us questions on Twitter, you can do that at Hudson Institute, and also you can follow us on Facebook at Hudson Institute at Facebook.com. Our first speaker will be Ambassador Patrick Duddy. He is the last U.S. ambassador to Venezuela so far, serving from 2007 and 2010 with a bit of an interruption in the middle caused by the Venezuelans. He is currently visiting senior lecturer at Duke University. He'll be followed by Professor Anibal Romero, professor of political theory at Simon Bolivar University in Caracas, Venezuela, and has published several books, as people in this audience know, and articles on Venezuelan politics and President Chavez. Third, Antonio José de la Cruz is an energy specialist who has worked for many years with the energy companies in Venezuela and here, and still does, from the United States, I understand. But we're pleased he was able to join us. And John Perdue is director of Latin American programs at the Fund for American Studies. It's widely published regarding Latin America and the United States. His latest book, The War of All the People, The Nexus of Latin American Radicalism and Middle Eastern Terrorism. We have some copies out in front. If any of you are interested in purchasing, you may do so for $20 as you leave. But I want to thank all of them for generously joining us today. And I'll let them start explaining what's going on in Venezuela. Thank you. Mr. Ambassador.
Okay. Thank you, John. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you to the Hudson Institute for inviting me, and, of course, my sympathy to Ambassador Derenbloom, an old friend from Costa Rica from more than 25 years ago. I think that the four of us have determined we're going to stay seated, though I have a penchant for leaping out of my chair. From time to time, I'll try to control myself, and what I hope to do is is run through some fairly general observations for you about what I think happened and what it signifies. And then with my colleagues, all very knowledgeable individuals here on the panel, perhaps we can entertain some of the concerns that you doubtless have and or share with one another some of our continuing concerns. As a number of you may know, sometime ago, about a month and a half ago, authored a contingency memorandum for the Center for Preventive Action of the Council on Foreign Relations, in which I was asked initially to consider what our position ought to be, our posture ought to be, what the U.S. government's posture ought to be in the event that there was a breakdown in law and order and an interruption in democracy. That paper was never intended to consider all outcomes, especially happy endings, but simply to react to the perception that many people had that there was a threat or a danger hanging over the process. I think it's important to recognize, as we sit here today, that notwithstanding other considerations, the election took place. It was a relatively orderly affair, and we have seen broad Venezuelan acceptance of the results of the election in virtually every quarter of the country. Now, I'm going to come back to that point a little bit later, but I think that's a good place to start. Now, what happened in the most sort of reductive and statistical way to explain it? President Chavez won approximately 55% of the vote, and Capriles, his opponent, approximately 45% of the vote. The turnout was something on the order of something north of 80% of the eligible electorate. That's an immense turnout. President Chavez received, according to the national electoral authorities, over 8,135,000 or so votes. His challenger, Governor Capriles, received about 6.5 million votes. The campaign was marred in a couple of places by incidents of violence. These were lamentable, but did not manifestly prevent an enormous percentage of all of the elected, the Venezuelan voters who wished to participate in the election to get to the polls. Now, while President Chavez enjoyed nearly unlimited resources, significant media time, and was able to feature many of the government's assistance programs in the course of the campaign. It is also clear from what we have been able to see that Governor Capriles both was able and did successfully mount an extraordinarily broad-based campaign. Now, I emphasize that not to, in any sense, burnish the victory for President Chavez, but because I think that the evidence on the ground really needs to be, in a sense, recalled or kept in mind as we consider other issues. Let me give you just a couple of examples. This was one of the late Capriles rallies. Another. Bottom line, the Capriles campaign was not conducted in secret, right? And I think that's an important thing for us to remember. The Capriles campaign obviously was broad-based, widely supported. People showed up in public places identifying themselves with that campaign. This doesn't nullify or invalidate those concerns expressed domestically within Venezuela or elsewhere for the advantages that the incumbent was able to avail himself of. But it is worth noting the size, the scope of what was happening. The Capriles campaign was a very, very substantial challenge, and it was allowed to develop. Allowed, it was their right to develop it, but given the tenor of the criticisms often directed at President Chavez, it's also worth noting it was allowed to develop. It foisted itself, indeed, on the public consciousness. Now, what did we expect? Who guessed? What did we know? As late as a few days before October 7th, the polls were showing dramatically different results or different possible outcomes. I think I saw summaries of at least four or five polls in the week or so before the election. And one or two of them favored or predicted, anticipated a win by Capriles. Three or four predicted a victory by President Chavez. It turns out that none of the polls, or maybe one, maybe data analyses, got it right more or less statistically. But many of the rest of the polls were, as we would say, all over the map. The question I've asked myself is, was there ever a time in the period just before the election when a majority of the polls predicted a Capriles win? As nearly as I have been able to identify, the answer to that is no. At every point throughout the campaign, most of the polls continued to predict that Chavez would be reelected. And the question was really by what kind of margin, and at the conclusion of what kind of campaign. Right? That's a critical consideration, because as we know, 13 months or so ago, the president's brother actually at one point, while the president was recovering from his first operation for cancer, the president's brother actually alerted the party faithful that they needed to be prepared to defend the revolution by force of arms. This, as an opening gambit in the campaign, certainly stimulated concern, it seems to me, among many who support democracy in the hemisphere. That said, at no point did a majority of the polls show that Capriles was going to win. So I'm not sure that it was reasonable to assume, or would be reasonable to assume, that something happened, except for one thing. Which I think is noteworthy. President Chavez began the campaign season ill, clearly still in recovery mode. He looked like he was obviously on various kinds of medication as a consequence of his two or three operations for cancer. And there was a palpable sense that he was significantly weaker than previously, than in earlier campaigns. However, for those of you who track such things, it's quite clear that his participation rose over the course of the campaign. And as it rose, I think he was able to, along with the various assistance programs and other kinds of inducements that were being pushed out the door. As his participation rose, so did enthusiasm for his reelection. Now, how do we understand what happened? First of all, a couple of things are clear. Despite crime, deteriorating infrastructure, a slow and some would argue almost artificial recovery. Chavez's connection with his own political base remains strong. Now, this in no way nullifies the significance of the mood, that is to say, the Mesa Unitaria Democrática and its accomplishments, but the voter turnout seemed to me to have been too large to for us to account for it entirely by suggesting that this was a function of sort of in the abuse of the powers of the incumbency. There is still a strong Chavista base. The PSUV and the government were very well organized on the election. This is not a surprise, but it's at least worth noting. You know, you don't get an 80% turnout, of course, if the public itself isn't engaged. But in a country with the infrastructure challenges that Venezuela has, it's clear that both the government and the democratic opposition were well organized and got their people to the polls. Access to the polls, according to most observers, was unimpeded. And as I think most observers anticipated, the vote count per se appears to have been accurate. Capriles conceded early and did not challenge the outcome of the vote. I suspect this is because his own people understood early through exit polling, quick counts, etc., that in fact he had lost the election. I just note, as we think about what happened, there was a very high level of expectation that maybe, particularly given the results of some of the polling, Consultores 21 and certain others, that Capriles might win. I think that was founded in part on an examination of the results after the 2007 referendum and the 2010 legislative elections. A difference I would note in those two elections and this one is that in neither of those was Chavez himself per se a candidate. He wasn't on the ballot. Right? He wasn't on the ballot. Now, having acknowledged that the president's connection to his base is still substantial, I think it's very important, again, I'm just going to put it up there because I'm so stunned by the size of these things, the size of the Capriles campaign, the rallies, the popularity that was manifest, particularly in the last 6 weeks or so of the campaign. It is not too much, I think, for us to acknowledge that a campaign of this size, with this measure of support, more than 6 million votes, is manifestly evident not just of the participation of the old elites, the traditional parties. There is now a popular base which extends well beyond what we saw in earlier national elections in Venezuela. Its long-term significance, however, won't yet, I think, be evident until after the gubernatorial and municipal elections. If, in fact, having selected candidates for the gubernatorial elections and the mayoral elections in their primary, if, in fact, they're able to recover from this defeat, although it's not necessarily a setback, and successfully campaign for governorships and city halls around the country. I think what we can conclude is that there has been a kind of substantial change in the nature of the opposition to President Chavez on the ground. The last time around in the gubernatorial elections, the opposition won 5 states. There's subsequent defections from the Chavista camp have put more states in play and in the opposition camp, but they only won 5 states. Capriles did not carry all of those states this time around. But once again, while he will be on the ballot in Miranda, President Chavez will not be on the ballot. And so we'll be given an opportunity to see just what kind of appeal the party has now beyond President Chavez himself. He has always been, it seems to me, a figure that was larger than the political vehicle he had he created. We'll see what sort of support that vehicle has, given that many of his most high-profile supporters will in fact be running for office in December. So, in a sense, where are we? Well, in the first week of October of this year, and where are we, in, if you will, bilaterally, Venezuela sold approximately 900,000 barrels of oil a day to the United States. It's down a little bit from what they were selling us in September, but roughly the same number that has been reported regularly for the last few years. They're below 1 million, but still a significant contributor to the U.S. supply of petroleum. It does, however, represent, in all probability, a part of their market which continues to be substantially more important to them than it is to us. That doesn't mean it isn't important to us, but we use about 19 million barrels a day. We now produce over half of what we use, and we import the rest. Venezuela has an important part of that market, but it is not a majority share of the market. Our largest oil suppliers are Canada, Mexico. Colombia is coming on strong, et cetera. So it's still a very important relationship, but perhaps not as important as it has sometimes been in the past. Venezuela's capacity to produce more oil is very much a subject of debate, and I believe that one of my colleagues on the panel will discuss that in more detail. But what is clear is that while they are sitting on arguably the world's largest reserves, their actual production capability has never recovered to the level that it was when President Chavez took office. It continues to be somewhere on the order of about 2.5 million barrels a day of crude, cum crude, not counting blends, synthetics, etc. As Chavez comes out of this election, infrastructure is still immensely important. That's going to take resources. What kind of resources is he going to have at his disposal? That's a question mark. He's borrowed something approximating $40 billion from the Chinese. But some of that he's already spending. Some of it he spent during the campaign. And the reason this is significant for the future is much of what he has borrowed will have to be repaid in product. In order for there to be sort of a net gain in liquidity, financial liquidity, production will have to go up. Right? Production will have to go up. And it remains to be seen if, in fact, that will happen. The government is still going to have to deal with violence. It is a contributing factor to the extraordinarily high levels of anxiety that many Venezuelans feel. Yesterday, one of the major Venezuelan dailies reported that 57 bodies showed up at the Belomonte morgue over the long weekend. So this continues to be a huge problem. In a sense, as I was preparing to speak this morning, I thought to myself, maybe I should say what's new, what's changed, what's the same, right? Chavez has been reelected. That didn't surprise a lot of people, notwithstanding the hope that had been expressed for a Capriles win. Oil production is about what it was. Crime is about what it was. The government's enthusiasm for some of the countries with which we have the greatest difficulty is as it was. It has not receded. What has changed is that President Chavez has been given another 6-year lease on the presidential palace. And I think that raises some interesting issues for us as a policy matter, and I suspect we will talk about that further today. But to just touch on a couple of things. Obviously, his reelection, following this very public and for many people very exciting opposition challenge, his reelection reassured his ALBA partners, clearly, and I suspect also many of the Petro Caribe partners. I note that it was often commented, sometimes by candidates, some by others, that almost certainly there would have been changes, in particular, to the government's foreign assistance program, largely a matter of discounting oil shipments to partners around the hemisphere. Many people speculated that would change had Capriles been elected. He wasn't. It probably won't in the near term. But that, of course, remains a challenge for the administration, specifically because in their efforts to both diversify away from the American market and to bring more cash on board immediately for infrastructure projects, presumably, but also for the election, et cetera, a certain amount of the future production is now basically contracted, you know, or obligated to China. Just a couple of other points. UNASUR sent an observation team, or acompañantes. There wasn't an OAS, a CAPEL mission on the ground. I think we ought to consider what that signifies, both in terms of a future role for UNASUR. Is it, you know, in a sense, going to become a real player? But also, what does it signify for the OAS? I think it's a consideration. I was struck by the fact after the election that, unless I missed something, that none of the governments of the hemisphere criticized, challenged the outcome, or even substantially criticized the character of the campaign. There were lots of criticisms here, but not much elsewhere. And post-election, what we heard largely were messages of congratulations, some only to the Venezuelan people, but many also to the government. As we think about whether the U.S.-Venezuelan bilateral relationship, it seems to me necessary that we think about that relationship in the context of our relations with the whole hemisphere, acknowledging among ourselves, certainly, that in any public way, much of the rest of the hemisphere has declined either to comment on or criticize, and indeed has given evidence that they are comfortable with the outcome of these elections. Now, the Inter-American Press Association has criticized the Venezuelan government for its media policies, et cetera. This doesn't mean criticism goes away, but it does suggest an interesting sort of geopolitical division. We still have interests in Venezuela. Our interest, obviously, in democracy in the hemisphere is long established. But there are also, if you will, much more immediate interests. We have an interest in counter-terrorist cooperation. We have an interest in counter-narcotics cooperation. We still have a very substantial trade relationship. And we have an important energy relationship. President Chavez has been returned to office. He has had cancer, but he appears to have recovered at least sufficiently to campaign successfully. Where we go from here, it seems to me, is an important question, not one we will answer alone, but that relationship is a shared relationship. There is a certain symbiosis, whether we like to acknowledge it or not. And what I would conclude simply by noting that it seems to me what we do now and how we interact with a government which has been returned to power without any criticism of any significance from the rest of the hemisphere is going to be a tough question for our policymakers. So I'll stop there. I hope I didn't go too long.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn.
Professor Romero.
Thank you, and the Hudson Institute for inviting me. Thank you all for being with us this afternoon. Before I go into my presentation, I'd like to refer to a report which was published in the Venezuelan newspaper El Nacional a few days after the recent elections, according to which President Hugo Chavez got 69% of the vote in the Venezuelan prisons. When I read this, I thought, is this a metaphor for the situation in my country as a whole? I mean, are we voting for our jailers? It's easy to despair about Venezuela if you are in the country and after 14 years of Chavista rule. I myself have felt that way sometimes. But it is a mistake to despair. It's too early to give up hope. And it is a mistake because there is another side to the story, which speaks of resistance, a young leadership which is intelligent, working hard, and has the best interests of the country at heart. If you think that Capriles wasn't only competing with Chavez, but with the whole power of the Venezuelan state, I think we'll gain a better perspective to understand the significance of the fact that the opposition obtained 45% of the vote. I don't like to talk about electoral fraud, but I certainly will talk about electoral corruption. The whole system is vitiated. And I'm talking about a fourth generation electoral war, technological electoral warfare. Let me give you one example. And I'll be happy to give any one of you who is interested in this particular matter, which is important for the future too, the internet addresses where you can find detailed information about the Venezuelan electoral system and its flaws. But let me mention one example of the problem we face. When you go to a voting center in Venezuela, which is usually a school, secondary school, primary school, and then go into the classroom to vote, you will find representatives from the National Electoral Council, the opposition, and the government. And you will also find two machines, the actual voting machine and another one which comes first and with which you have to deal first. This is a capta huellas, a machine that checks your fingerprint. Only after you have done this on this machine will the voting machine activate. No wonder that 63% of the Venezuelan people think that the government knows who you are voting for. And in a country in which more than 50% of the people depend some way or another on the government for their lives for their economic survival. I would consider this to be a fundamental distortion of the electoral system. Now, why didn't the opposition denounce this? Because they believe there is a dilemma here. They think that if they question the electoral system, they will generate a feeling of despondency, of defeatism, and also abstention, electoral abstention. Of course, this has a huge significance also for future elections, because in the kind of political system we have, under the kind of regime that we have, I believe it is a valid assessment to argue, it is a valid argument to say that they will let us grow, but they won't let us win. And I'll come back to this point a bit later. 45% of the vote fighting against a regime which had PDVSA financing the official campaign, which had the National Guard providing the logistical, the logistics and the mobilization of many pro-government voters or people who wanted to vote for the opposition or didn't want to vote but were forced to do it because they got calls. Let me make a parenthesis here. The so-called Misión Vivienda, which promises practically housing for free to the poor, has 3.5 million people, which has a waiting list. 3.5 million people, which hope that they will get a house or an apartment for free from the government. Many of them were called and asked at 12 o'clock at midday or 1 p.m. What has happened? Juan or Pedro or Lorenzo or whatever, you haven't voted yet. What about your apartment? So, PDVSA financing, the National Guard providing mobilization and logistical support, the militia and the paid officials of the ruling party controlling the voters, particularly in the poorer barrios. And yet, the opposition got more than 6 million votes. I'm not saying, because I don't know, that in a fair election, without this corrupt electoral system, and there are many more instances of electoral corruption, we would have won. What I'm saying is that the history of resistance is what gives us hope that Venezuela can change for the better. Also, the fact that the government has problems. And I want to go into the question that get us together today. What next? What may happen in Venezuela? The government has problems. First, it has created excessive expectations. Many of these well-meaning Venezuelans, poor Venezuelans, think that they are going to get their house or their apartment very soon. They will be frustrated, of course. Inflation, scarcity of basic products. People who know about these things tell us that in 2013, next year, the country will have to go through a macroeconomic adjustment of a significant dimensions. First, excessive expectations. Two, the economic crisis looming on the horizon. And finally, President Chavez's illness. The Venezuelan Constitution says in its article, I believe, 340, we not only have long constitutions, we have had 26 of them, and it's still running, says that if the president expires or has to leave for any reason before the first 4 years of his 6 years period. Am I making myself clear? Okay. There will have to be an election 30 days after. The appointment by President, recent appointment of Minister Maduro by President Chavez is, to my mind, a telling sign that they are thinking about a possible succession to the president. No important Chavista will ever tell Mr. Chavez, Mr. President, you have to, you know, make some preparations in the unlikely and undesirable case that... So, no, nobody will, in his right mind, will do that. But the Cubans will. And I think the Cubans have done this. Maduro is a trusted man in Havana. And I wouldn't be surprised if we had big political changes taking place in Venezuela sooner rather than later because of the constitutional crisis derived from the president's health condition. It is true, as Ambassador Dori pointed out, that many key aspects of Venezuelan life remain the same. But this may be, this may be deceiving us. You know, because among other things, one thing has changed a lot. The situation of the Venezuelan opposition. We now have a leader. We have motivation because one thing Capriles did, and let me tell you, I didn't like him very much. I voted for somebody else in the primary elections. I voted for Maria Corina Machado, who came almost last. I admire her a lot. I like her a lot. I think she's another one of these new leaders who represent the future for the country. But I have to admit that Capriles grew as a candidate and a politician, that he improved a lot, and that he produced two things we didn't have: emotion and credibility. And that is something to be treasured and cultivated. We have the regional and municipal elections coming soon. What does the opposition need to do? Preserve its unity, protect Capriles' leadership, personal leadership, organize better, and this is my personal view. I am not a member of the inner circles, decision-making circles of the Mesa de Unidad Democrática. This is my personal view, but I think there are quite a few people who think this way. I believe that there is a lot of room for improvement as far as the message is concerned. First, we have to admit, when I say we, I am thinking about non-Chavista Venezuelans, and not all Chavistas are bad Venezuelans. Far from it. I would never say something like that. We have to humbly admit that more research needs to be done concerning the nature of Chavez's connection with the masses, and also concerning the way we can go beyond the idea that the only way to win the support of the poorer Venezuelans is to present the image of a Chavez light. I think we have to go beyond the social programs for purely assistentialist and short-term purposes, because these programs are designed to create dependency. And I think it is not only a political challenge, but also an ethical one to provide, to present to the Venezuelan people a different vision, going beyond assistentialist social programs, a vision of progress for all, of participation, but not of dependency. Also, I think that the dilemma between fighting for fair electoral conditions or creating abstention is a false dilemma. I hear people saying sometimes that the Venezuelan people, particularly the poor, are only interested in free gifts from the government. What I say to friends of mine who say these things is, well, if that is the case, what would be the purpose of fighting for a people like that? I mean, politics is also a learning process, and it is the duty, by the way, President Chavez perhaps intuitively understands this very well. Chavez is, if you want to put it between inverted commas, Chavez is a teacher. If you see him on television, and for the nature of my métier, of my profession, I have to do it, he's always teaching a class. All the time. He's a natural teacher. Even if many of his lessons are not to my liking or perhaps yours. And because he understands that politics is also a learning process, and that it can be, as a great American political scientist Carl Deutsch put it in a wonderful book, which is now not as mentioned as some years ago, not as read as some years ago, The Nerves of Government, which I recommend you very much to read. He says that political learning can be creative or pathological. Pathological learning leads you to make the same mistakes all the time. Creative learning leads you to overcome challenges and to understand in a clearer way the environment you are interacting with. Now, I think that Capriles and the opposition have the political challenge and the moral duty to tell the truth to the Venezuelan people and to present a different vision of the future. For instance, and I'll finish in a couple of minutes. I'm sorry if I have taken more time than I should have. Capriles, and I respect him very much, I admire him. Capriles said very little about the fact that Venezuela has become the main guarantor of the survivability of the Castro despotism in Cuba, and that we have 40 or 50,000 Cubans intervening in key aspects of Venezuelan life. He said very little about that. Capriles said very little about our political prisoners. This should become a banner, una bandera, for the activities of the opposition. The opposition has the moral duty to fight for the liberation of our political prisoners. I have counted about 24 political prisoners languishing in Venezuelan jails. Now, we have had more over the last 14 years. But even if we had one, this should be a cause for concern and to fight for fighting for the opposition. Also, I think, and I finish with this, I think that the Venezuelan opposition must fight for fairer electoral conditions, and that this can be done. I really don't buy the argument that denouncing this flawed and corrupt electoral system provokes abstention. On the contrary, what I have found is that people get angry and get motivated with this. Well, in short, what I wanted to tell you is that we should put in perspective and have with the right sense of proportion, a balanced view of what is going on in Venezuela, and that I think there are substantial reasons to hope for a change for the better in my country. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Romero. Let me now turn to Mr. De La Cruz.
Thank you very much, John, for inviting me to the
Hudson
Institute. Can you hear me?
No.
You may have to pull a little closer. You shouldn't have to push the button.
Hello?
Does that work?
Hello, works? Yes.
Okay.
What I'm going to do today... Okay, it's this one. It's not working, this one.
You're right.
Okay, I'm going to give a brief introduction to the economic look. The first is one chart, PDVSA role in the economy, and we're going to talk a little bit. Of course, I'm going to talk about the electoral process as Aníbal did, as Venezuela, and how Chavez won this election. I want to present a hypothesis that probably you will get some ideas additional to what Aníbal and Ambassador said before. The economy is, at the moment, is the higher world inflation rate, running on average over 22% in 2012. Exchange rate have three exchange rate, 4.3, Kadivi, 5.3, CME, and 10, around 10 or more than 10, black market. And the international reserves of the country is threefold. In August 2012, there were 25 billion. Okay. Imports have increased almost fivefold since 2003, failed to alleviate the chronic shortage of supplies, food, medicine, etc. Declining oil production and refineries igniting and the collapse of the infrastructure. The runaway debt in 2007 was less than $30,000 million and now exceeds $200,000 billion. A devaluation of 50 to 70% is predicted to help close the fiscal gap between the and narrow the gulf between the official currency exchange rate and the black market. Let's see the oil. In the oil export by region, we have 2007 on the left and 2011, okay, on the right. If you see the blue one, which is the United States, is 69% on those days, and now it's 43% in last year, which is around less 800,000 barrels a day. It's around that. But we see also how the distribution has changed. Okay, we see China, okay, is not mentioned in 2007, but when we see 2011, we see that China is, the red one, is 19% of oil exports. Okay, this is due to the, was mentioned before, okay, the loans from the Chinese government to exchange by oil production, okay, basically. But also the other big change there is the Caribbean, okay. The Caribbean in 2007 was 15%, and last year was 30% down. That is the geopolitical area that the government uses. If we see also the price and the production, here I'm quoting OPEP. Okay, but OPEP in recently, what he has done, he takes official quota, but he also asks to an independent board to assess that also. And we have a difference. That is why it's a red on the top and a blue, which is the independent. Okay, there is a gap there. But if we see, since 1999, when he took office, President Chavez, the price has increased enormously, okay, while the production is declining. If we see also the external debt from PDVSA, okay, we see production declining and the amount of money, I mean, in external debt is huge. The red one is the Chinese fund, okay, which is around $30 billion, and those, the blue one, are the one that PDVSA bonds has emitted in the last 5 years, which is a totally, about $30 billion more. So PDVSA is in total debt at the moment, okay? Saying that, I would like to move to the electoral process. I divide the electoral process in three phases or three sub-processes, which is the electoral campaign, the vote casting, and the results. I think that's the main phases that we have. And I think that Capriles did a very good job on the electoral campaign, okay, when Ambassador shows all these mass demonstrations, okay, or rallies. That is the motion Capriles put in the campaign, okay. If we see this, I don't know if you like know how boxing is, three in the, in no professional way. The first round was won by Capriles because he put more emotion to the to the voters than Chavez. But the second round, vote casting and results, is the key for Chavez. Okay? That is the key that Chavez knows how to deal with. How is our process? Very quickly, as Aníbal mentioned, in the step one, you enter to the high school or to the school, and they capture you, okay, your ID, to tell you where to go, to what class you have to go. After that, you go to the class, you get again, okay, your fingerprint to allow the machine to let you take your vote. You vote in the third station, okay, which is the one on the top. It's electronic, I remember. He produced a receipt, okay, the ballot, and you introduce it in the boxes. And at the end, you sign the book that you vote and put your fingerprint again. And the last one, you get E as a proof that you vote. If you see this process, there is some elements that are very interesting. In two stations, they capture your fingerprint. And that is online process. That is not disconnected. The one who is disconnected when you vote, I'm talking me electronically, because that is connected to the database from the government, SIME. Okay. And as we know, if it's, you know the fingerprint, you know who is in the electoral center. Not who is what you vote for, but you know is entering the center when you get here. That is immediate data that PSUV or the situational room knows. And that is the way they control who is in the central. After that, you check it again when you allowed, when you are in the class, and in the step three, when you vote for your candidate, okay, in my case, that screen was only 10 inches. Everybody knows in that room for what, for whom I vote. Because if you go your finger on your top, it was Chavez. Chavez was aligned all on the top. And Capriles was aligned all on the bottom. So if I move my fingerprint on the top, they knew it I was voting for Chavez. If I put it on the bottom, they knew it that I was voting for Capriles. The president of the table, as we call it, La Mesa, she asked me, press your face. And I said, I did it. Because it was so obvious. She said, press your face up and down. I mean, that introduced an element that is not fair. Okay, and we'll see it later. Because it's not a private moment with myself. Okay, they know it immediately, if they were very carefully, for who vote each one who was in that. I'm sure that Aníbal happened the same. The screen was at the most here, doesn't cover you at all. It's not a private moment. Okay? The vote is secret. I am agreeing with Aníbal that there is no fraud in that station, step three, because there are so many elements there that it's very difficult. And I have friends who works for the government and vote for the position and never been found out that they vote for the position. So that means that the secrecy of the vote exists, and always we have been thinking that the key is in that area. The key is in this area, because they know who is in the center and how can we pressure that. We're going to escape there, because what they did, the next one I put at the last, okay? They had this. They said, we're going to use this time and a strategy, which is 1x10. A militant, or they call it patrullero, okay, has to fill out a form with this ID, name and surname and phone number. That is why they could call you at any time while you are not voting, while you're still at home. And they did that because since it's an online process, they could have monitoring how the voters have been attending and how been the vote, and so they know who have been going to the centers. Okay? And they have they could do the action plans to take moving the people, because they knew how many people for each center were voting. And they don't care about the opposition voters, okay? Because they only care about their people. They have to guarantee that they have to go and vote, okay? Because it's the one that they have. Immediately when you put the fingerprint, they have the ID, because that is a given data. Okay, so the key is here. If you see the 1x10 by them, this how they got at the end, they talking about these are the militants and how they vote. They got 8,136,964, and they were aiming 9 million votes. These figures always was mentioned by Chavez when he was giving his speeches. He said, we're going to get 9 million. It's because of that. Because everyone have to have 1x10. And if we see it, I present it in this way because these are, in the last column, you will see that the real movement of the machinery of the state. Okay, Vargas was the most successful. They move, if you put how many militants they have, okay, they book 11 for one of each other. Let's see the last one. And this, I think, I divided, remember, the process, the electoral process by three steps. Electoral campaign, vote casting, and results. In the electoral campaign, there is a social control on the lower class through the social programs, naming misiones. That is introduced, I'm sure, by the Cubans. Intensive use of television by Chavez to intimidate the people who believe who benefits from mission or social program, resulting in electoral coercion. Well-planned distribution of electoral center, given a course of action on the electoral day. This is, they know by the people who is voting that electoral center doesn't support Chavez is going to get be a very slow process to cast your vote to discourage the voter. Okay. In the intensive use of television, okay, Chavez used to talk, if I recall, something like 100 times more than Capriles. On the voting casting, okay, as I mentioned earlier, online information of voters, when they enter the electoral center, with emphasis on the ones registered on the list 1 by 10. That is one of the key. The mobilization, as Aníbal mentioned, capacity on the election day by the use of all the means that the state has, like van, cars, buses, truck, and those like PDVSA, Guard, National Guard, they use all the means to mobilize those people. Okay? And of course, the buying power of some voters. The state buys some voters who are interested in selling their vote. And in the results, there is an strategy there also, which is that CNE, Electoral National Council alignment to announce the winner before all centers are closed. Hence, the opposition representative, once the result is known, feel like they are not needed anymore, and therefore they don't care anymore on the final result. And they left the center, the electoral center. And what happened that? They could handle the data when you don't have a representative, if the center is not closed. Okay. Those are my remarks so far. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Mr. Dale Cruz. Mr. Perdue.
It's pure serendipity, but my comments are going to mesh fairly well with both Aníbal and Antonio Jose. Can you hear? Is this still? Let me start by saying I'm going to do a little bit of post-mortem on the election, but I also want to cover the security implications of a continuation of the Chavez regime in power. On election night, two Sundays ago, some colleague and I went to an election night party up in DuPont Circle, and you know, we were expecting, you know, there were rumors of good polling coming out ahead of that time, and but we weren't expecting too much. But about 9 or 10 o'clock, as the election results started rolling in, there was not caterwauling or devastation. It was, to me, it looked more like stoicism and general acceptance of the results. So I'd have to say that most people it seemed were somewhat expecting results like that. Maybe not expecting exactly those results, but they were certainly prepared that they could happen. One of the best analogies I think I heard at this event about the election was like Capriles playing a soccer game against Chavez on a steep hill with Chavez's goal at the bottom and Capriles is at the top. And a little bit about what I want to touch on is what is the slope of that hill and what are the, not just what Antonio Jose just showed you about the ability that the government has to affect the vote through retail fraud, but also mostly through the external influences that are coming in now into the country from Iran, Russia, Cuba, especially like Aníbal mentioned, Cuba. It is the continuation of the regime in Venezuela is an existential threat to Fidel Castro and Raul Castro and to Cuba. But it was the Chavez regime that stepped in with subsidized oil shipments to Cuba that has maintained that regime for these years. So the other thing is every year, about a year ago, a colleague of Antonio Jose and I went to a briefing by one of the main pollsters in Venezuela, and he had done a regression analysis of the election, what voter behavior and what issues kind of affected voter behavior more than the others. And by far and away, the one that dominated all the others was government largesse or misiones, the government payouts to individuals, the free homes. I saw an article the week before the election about a doctor that had been given an apartment had no running water yet, but they said, move in, you got it. He had to go fetch pails from the local well, but things like that take place. But every time elections roll around in Venezuela, we get this video out of the state-run TV service of Chavez doing his Carol Merrill impression in front of a line of refrigerators and washing machines that he sent them in, shipped in from China, and he either gives them away or sells them at highly subsidized prices. And so the advantage here is far overwhelming to what we've been mentioned here. And sometimes you may not even need to get into all the capabilities that are available to Chavez to commit retail fraud through the voting machines or the thumbprints, because he can win the election just on these, retail politics at wholesale prices. I think is the best way to describe it. One of the things, besides China, you may have seen Russia recently gave Chavez a puppy that he named Rusia. This was just on the news about a month ago, and this is Chavez had gotten worked out a deal that, and the main point of it is that it produced $1.5 billion in cash on hand to Chavez prior to the election. And this is what they call walking around money, as your campaign consultants would call it here. But I also want to, pardon me for reading some of this, but I pulled out some of the best examples of this I could find from my book about how much of an advantage these influences produce and how the vastness of them, for one thing. This is from the Washington Times in February of 2012. Because it had been tapped repeatedly to pay for Mr. Chavez's various social projects, PDVSA had been forced to go on a borrowing spree in recent years. In 2006, it borrowed $2.5 billion. As of December 2011, that figure had shot up to $35 billion. An uncovered document summarized a February 2010 meeting between Venezuelan and Chinese officials that illustrates the fuzzy nature of Mr. Chavez's oil dealings. It shows that Chavez originally requested one loan of $116 billion over a decade, a deal that would have required Venezuela to repay Beijing 250,000 barrels of oil per day for 10 years. That would be about one-third of the amount that the United States imports from Venezuela in November alone. The Chinese appear to have balked and asked to see an advance list of Mr. Chavez's projects that he would finance with the loans. Chavez pressed for at least $20 billion and offered cut-rate prices per barrel of oil to get more money up front. In order to close the deal, he offered China a price of $70 a barrel, substantially below the current and predicted price for the near term. No other details are known about the deal. Oil is now trading about $95 a barrel. Chinese state banks have lent $75 billion to regional governments, and these are almost 100% to ALBA countries, and nobody's named this before, but the ALBA Alliance are all the Chavista nations, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, that are aligned with Bolivarian socialism that Chavez touts. The Inter-American Development Bank, Import-Export Bank, lends less in Latin America than China has done in the last 5 years. Venezuela and Ecuador alone received 61% of that. We mentioned Cuba, the existential threat there. I've heard between 10,000 and 60,000, could be even higher than that, Cuban agents, Cuban operatives that are operating in Venezuela today, and that includes highest levels of the military. We've had a lot of reports come out from Venezuelan military officers that are very, very upset that, you know, it may be they were trained for years to fight terrorists in the region, and some of these are the people that train those terrorists, and now they're having to take orders from them. And a lot of these are you hear about sports trainers. The best reports we've gotten are the sports trainers are maybe attached to a military unit, so to for instance, and their purpose is to inform upon who within that brigade, for instance, is not loyal to Chavez. And they even had there was a document uncovered that even showed what process they were planning to use to either retire early or boot people out of the military that weren't loyal to Chavez. All of this is still contingent on the ability of Chavez over the last 13 years to build up what is now a critical mass of people whose livelihoods, as Anibal mentioned, are dependent upon the continuation of the regime. And that alongside that environment, if one votes incorrectly, as Antonio Jose mentioned, someone in the government will have access to that information, as we've seen. Some of you may know about the Tascon list, and there was one other list, I can't recall the name, of people that they actually published these on a website before several years ago of who voted correctly and who didn't. Excuse me. I've seen let me get from the Wall Street Journal. In 2010, Venezuela accounted for at least 40% of Cuba's overall trade in goods, up from 27% the year before. That figure was more than the trade levels of the next five countries combined. Overall, Venezuelan assistance in trade with Cuba accounted for up to 22% of Cuba's annual economic output in 2010. 105,000 cut-rate barrels of oil a day, about half of Cuba's energy needs for petroleum, economists believe, and cash payments for a stream of Cuban doctors, sports trainers, and teachers. Under the arrangement, Venezuela pays the Cuban government $135,000 a year for each doctor it sends over, 27 times the salary of the average Venezuelan doctor. And not only does that Venezuela sell the oil to Cuba, but is believed that to be at sub-market prices. It also extends Cuba 25-year loans at 1% interest, well below the rate of inflation that Havana uses to foot half the bill. Venezuela is also supporting Cuba through investment. From 2000 to 2011, Venezuela signed deals for 370 investment projects in Cuba for an estimated $11 billion. They included $1.4 billion to renovate the idle refinery in the coastal town of Cienfuegos. And this was an old Soviet refinery that had been shut down and there were no parts made for at least 15 years. But the more immediate security threat that we hear a lot about these days is Iran, of course. And not only are they in throughout the region looking for ideological partnerships, they're also looking for ways to – the thing they do mostly is go – find the diaspora in Latin America and recruit, fundraise, and kind of pick out potential recruits for terrorism activities amongst that diaspora. But prior to 2005, the amount of Iranian investment in the region was zero. But just in the past 6 years alone, Iran and Venezuela have conducted over $40 billion in deals. Former Ambassador Roger Noriega reported in April 2011 that there were a couple of Iranian Hezbollah trainers that did training on Margarita Island. This is north of on the northern coast of Venezuela, were operatives who were brought there from throughout Latin America. According to Noriega, there's a network of mosques and Islamic centers throughout Latin America that are part of this network. They recruit through them. They process people through them. And the most promising recruits include Latin American converts to Islam. They send them back to the Iranian city of Qom, which is a training center there and since the late 1970s has been a training center for terrorists. Conventional wisdom is that it's all religious training, but they actually learn terrorist techniques, explosives, bomb-making, and arms training. This was verified last year. In December of 2011, Univision did a really in-depth and striking documentary about this and actually had a whistleblower, a Mexican guy that had been sent to Qom and had been trained, and one of the trainers was an Argentine Islamist that had been traveling throughout the region and training and recruiting these people. Iran is by far the linchpin of our security concerns in Venezuela and throughout the region. And to refresh the memory of some of the more worrisome affiliations of the Chavez regime with those that may want to do harm to the U.S., remember that a Venezuelan flying from Caracas to Gatwick Airport in the U.K. was arrested in 2003 with a live grenade in his luggage. And when the U.K. police tried to get information on him, there was no cooperation whatsoever as far back as 2003 with the Venezuelan government. And although he was later convicted of terrorism charges, the conviction was done without any help from Venezuela, which refused all British and American requests for further information. And it has since refused all requests for information. Another Venezuelan citizen who went to school in New Jersey with some of the 9/11 hijackers. Members of his family also in Venezuela had ties to terrorist groups. But as the U.S. gathered more information on both of these gentlemen, they kept asking the Venezuelan embassy or the Venezuelan government for information. None was available. All they would say was that that person had left Venezuela and there was nothing known about his whereabouts. And besides this covert support for Hezbollah, U.S. requests for information have been dismissed for a long time. This from a 2006 hearing here on Capitol Hill. Congressman Brad Sherman was interviewing Ambassador Shapiro at the time. He said, "Have we confronted the Venezuelan government with our concerns?" Shapiro replies, "Over the last 2 years, our embassy in Caracas has sought on 20 different occasions to have meetings with government of Venezuela officials who have responsibility for counterterrorism. We have not had a single meeting with the government on these issues over the past 2 years. Let me go a little bit further than that. The bread and butter work of counterterrorism cooperation is the exchange of information regarding bank accounts, people coming in and out of countries, phone numbers, email accounts. Over the past 3 years, the embassy in Caracas has submitted roughly 130 requests for information on different types of biographical and immigration-related information on potential suspects, and to date has not received one single substantive response. Mr. Sherman asks again, I want to kind of crystallize this for the Venezuelan press that is in the audience. What this means is Hezbollah is proud that they have killed Americans. There's a Venezuelan citizen, Mr. Fatah, who attended school with the hijackers, and we have asked for cooperation, and in every respect, the response is that the Venezuelan government won't even meet with our people. Let me finish with this. There is currently legislation. A lot of the question we tend to get is, what can we do about this? And what we call this is benign neglect. And it was not just in the current administration, the past administration. There's always a trade-off between acknowledging the belligerence of a Hugo Chavez or a Fidel Castro and legitimizing their bluster. So that's understandable. But doing nothing sometimes seems to have only encouraged what's gone on. And there's currently, I want to mention, H.R. 3783. It's the first legislation that I've seen come through the Congress here that actually would require some action on this. And it was put by Representative Jeff Duncan from South Carolina. And it's called the Countering Iran in the Western Hemisphere Act. And it passed on September 19th. It passed the House and has been picked up by Senator Rubio in the Senate. And supposedly got stopped on a editing objection, but then supposedly will go back in the next lame duck session of Congress. The first thing I want to say is that this will require State Department to at least come up with a plan, at least make an assessment, come up with a plan to counter Iran in the hemisphere, and then actually report to Congress on what to do about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Perry.
I'd like to begin the question and answer session of the program by asking just the panel a couple questions, my own, and then I'll turn over to questions for the audience while you're thinking of what you'd like to ask. Let me ask them to address two things that came up in the discussion. First, Ambassador Duddy and especially mentioned the reaction of the rest of the hemisphere to the election and situation in Venezuela. A number of you referred to the use of oil and other monies to gain support by nations in the hemisphere. Obviously, it's helpful to have a number of allies who help to work on these problems. I'd like to ask, first of all, what do you see as the prospect of getting any allies to speak out and reinforce some of the things that you've talked about as criticisms and needs in policy for Venezuela, and what would you think the United States can do to foster that? And I'll start with Ambassador Dunn.
I'll take a crack at that, although, you know, in many respects, those are the big questions, I think, that we're looking at right now. One implication, it seems to me, of the extensive network of contracts for discounted oil that Venezuela has initiated under the Petrocaribe initiative is that a great many of the voting members of the OAS, an organization that by tradition works on consensus, great many of those members now have a vested interest in their relationship with Venezuela, and particularly at the current moment. That said, the hemisphere has embraced democracy all the way back in 9/11, when the Inter-American Democratic Charter was signed in Lima, Peru. It seems to me we need to be fully cognizant, on the one hand, of the extraordinary reach of Hugo Chavez's petro-diplomacy, on the one hand, but on the other hand, redouble our efforts to generate support for real democracy within the hemisphere. And that's going to mean engaging in a very intense way in the hemisphere, broadly throughout the hemisphere, cultivating relationships with Mexico, with Brazil, with Peru, and others. I believe that the major players in the hemisphere themselves take as axiomatic that the hemisphere has an interest in being understood to be a region dominated by, characterized by democracies. And we need to work with our hemispheric partners in figuring out how we turn that into an environment in which all of us are held to high standards. The reality is that it seems to me that also implies something of what Aníbal discussed, and that is a willingness internally, and it's going to be hard, to acknowledge the limitations of the current system in Venezuela by the opposition. I think Aníbal was exactly right that the there was a kind of catch-22 in the whole process of examining the character of the campaign. Catch-22 is if you effectively diminish and or dismiss the possibility of success because you say the campaign is too profoundly unfair to permit it, you are going to stimulate abstentionism. So it's going to be a long haul. I think that as a couple of our panelists have pointed out, though, that we're going to see any number of things over the horizon in Venezuela. It is still a profoundly divided society, and the divisions now are closer to the middle than previously. And if we, in fact, see a genuinely unified opposition, there may also be a cry for or support for a higher standard in terms of campaign conduct. But it's going to be very, very difficult, and it seems to me the circumstances on the ground, that is to say, a reelected President Chavez, whose reelection was not challenged by the opposition, largely recognized by the neighborhood, will be a very, very difficult basically a sort of reality for us to question within the hemisphere. This is apart from other kinds of considerations like our issues of counter-narcotics, counter-terrorism, et cetera.
Other comments about the collective alliance that is or is not helpful here?
The fact is that we cannot ask others to do for us what we don't do for ourselves. And Venezuela has had very few allies, the Venezuelan Democratic Opposition, over the years. One distinguished ally has been, and it still is, former President Uribe of Colombia. But I find it hard to think of anybody else in the whole hemisphere. As Ambassador Dori pointed out, it's fascinating that Chavez doesn't seem to be taken seriously by almost anybody, with the exceptions of us inside Venezuela, who suffered some of the consequences of his misrule. And I wonder if this is because he is not to be taken seriously as a security concern, or because there are so many problems elsewhere in the world that people don't find the time to focus their attention on that. Let me say one more thing. I have wondered sometimes that perhaps the United States is mainly concerned about Cuba, being stable, that no other crisis such as the Marielito crisis occurs, I guess another Mariel multiplied by 10 or 100 must be a nightmare scenario for U.S. Southern Command. I mean, that would be really horrible. And, I mean, is the United States government truly committed to democracy in Cuba, or is it a facade? And what they really want is stability. I would understand this, but of course this has a consequence, which is the main factor preserving stability in Cuba nowadays? Venezuela. So there is perhaps an interest in the status quo. I mean, I have no proofs about this. It's just something I
May I make just one? Yeah. May I add to this? Yeah. One. Let me just add one other observation with respect to support over time for either the government of Hugo Chavez by others in the hemisphere, questions about the relative lack of allies for the opposition. It's worth noting that the opposition has really been evolving and consolidating over time. I'm not sure if you would disagree, but in point of fact, until relatively recently, it has been axiomatic that the opposition was deeply fractured. And during my time in Venezuela, I occasionally talked with both political activists and pollsters, and it was often the case that, notwithstanding other challenges, when I talked to folks, one was always able to verify that there was a more monolithic base loyal to President Chavez, whereas the opposition always had to be analyzed in segments. And so coming back to your observation that, to some degree, Venezuelans can't expect others to do for the opposition what the opposition has not been able to do for itself. The Chavez, sort of Chavez's arrival was a phenomenon, and he did and does resonate with a certain sector of the population. That's one of the things that is borne out by the relatively higher level of success enjoyed by him and his associates when his name is actually on the ballot. He continues to be a figure that eclipses his own party, and that until this election, was not really rivaled by any other figure within the opposition, which isn't to say that there weren't significant opposition figures, but none that who loomed as large in the public imagination as President Chavez himself. And, you know, I would come back to some of those images of the campaign that I put up there. For that's what much of the hemisphere saw of the recent reality in Venezuela. And not surprisingly, it seems to me, we have not, we hear lots of questioning in other places about political freedoms, about economic policy, et cetera. But there has not been a surge of objections to the political situation, because it would appear, for much of the hemisphere at least, that there is now an opposition, but that the opposition was allowed to function. And at the same time, that opposition did not challenge in any significant way either the character of the campaign environment or the voting on election day. Now, did he have extraordinary resources at his disposal? Did he go beyond what most of us would consider anything we've seen in other places? Very possibly, but however you account for it, he appeared to have arrived, for the rest of the hemisphere at least, at a certain bar of legitimacy, sufficient at a minimum to mute any criticism.
Well, except it seems to me from your comments, it's not only some criticism not by the opposition, but whether you want to argue it's pro or con, also not made very forcefully by the United States, which could have pointed out some of the things that you pointed out and gotten the rest of the hemisphere to notice and made it a little more difficult for them to ignore it. Because if I understand the thrust of the panel, I'm not an expert on this, partly what you're saying is the linchpin to this continued survival of Cuba is Venezuela. The linchpin to the continued penetration and some danger with terrorists is significantly tied to Venezuela. The linchpin of increasing Chinese influence is Venezuela. And yet, it's fine for us to say the government of the United States' position is to kind of not have tit-for-tat arguments with Chavez, except that when they're a major national security threat, ignoring them makes you look both stupid and is misleading to not only the American people but to the rest of the hemisphere. It seems to me that's what I take from this. But let me ask one last question.
I think that's a perfectly legitimate set of observations.
And I'll open it up. Professor, you mentioned being prepared for big political change, by which I presume indication is that Chavez dies of his illness. I suppose some would call that the easy solution here, or that divine intervention. We don't control that. But what could the United States, what could outside allies, what could the internal opposition best do to prepare themselves for a successful transition should Chavez die? And I have some hesitation about kind of betting on this easy solution, but if you want to take it, and I think we have to take it seriously as an option, what's the preparation or the key points of preparation that would be important to kind of keep in mind if you want to capitalize on that opportunity?
A lot will depend on what the government decides to do, because according to the Constitution, if they want to make an amendment, which is changing one or two articles without transforming the substance of the Constitution itself. That's the definition of an amendment given by the Constitution itself, okay? If they want to do that so that Maduro can take charge as soon as Chavez dies without an election, they would still have to go to the people for a referendum to approve the amendment. What if, as I suspect they may be tempted to do, what if they decide to violate the Constitution, which is not so difficult for them, and simply have the National Assembly, the legislature, to approve the amendment, now that they have an absolute majority in the legislature for one of our representatives defected to the enemy about a month ago. So what if they decide to do that? I mean, that would create a crisis. The opposition would have to react. We might even have riots, civil disobedience. I don't know what the leadership in the opposition is thinking about this, but as I said before, a lot will depend on what the government decides to do. Because I like to add this. I don't think that any Chavista, apart from Chavez himself, as the ambassador has emphasized several times, would defeat Capriles.
Okay. Questions from the audience? Yes, sir. Could you just say your name and identify your affiliation? You wait for the microphone because this will be recorded.
Andy Jude from Perfil, Argentina. I was hearing all the conversation. It seems for a moment I was expecting something different, because we cannot cry. There is an expression in Spanish about the leche derramada, right? Where the milk is spilled, we cannot change it. We have to look it forward. And being from Argentina, we are following a lot of events. Remember that the first person who called Chavez when he won was our president, Cristina, right? And I have the sensation, and following what the ambassador said, that we are entering a new movement in South America, and the U.S. is not getting it. It's not getting the idea. It seems that you are lost and very, very lost of what's going on. It's going to be a division probably in Latin America. We are getting into that division soon, because it's not only the ALBA. The UNASUR had important partners that really don't care about the OAS for any longer. Asking the OAS what happens if they have ambassadors. Brazil and Argentina don't have ambassadors in this moment. They are interim ambassadors. They are not putting really all the interest in the OAS. Venezuela required to be out of the CIDH. That's the Commission of Human Rights. And other countries are also in the same path, like Ecuador. So it seems there's going to be a disconnection, and I want to know the panel, what thinks between the U.S. or some countries that are very ally of the U.S. and this new world in South America, that the problem is where this new world will go, because also there is Iran, they are touching Argentina, is going to have some meetings with Iran during the next month. So the situation is how the U.S. will react, or what's the idea of the U.S. based on this new independence that all these countries are looking forward in the Western Hemisphere. They feel that for many, many, many years, they were following the U.S. pattern, and this is the time for change. If you hear all the politicians, that's what they are saying, and this is the time for Latin America or the Latino, and really it's going to be a new world. It depends on the... I want to see the next debate, the 22nd, probably, and I want to see if they get this, and this is not only a thing that happened in the process of Venezuela and all these countries that are getting this idea, but also I think it's a failure of the U.S. See how many travels or trips the President Obama did to the region. Only one. And he only visited two or three countries. So this is a real problem, and we are not getting the idea. That's my...
Let me get some comments from the panel on the change in the trajectory and the American comprehension and handling of this.
Well, you know, I wrote an op-ed piece not very long ago in which I emphasized that I thought we needed to move Latin America up toward the top of our foreign policy agenda for a host of reasons. 42% of our exports now flow to the Western Hemisphere, which makes it immensely more important than I think most members of the American public understand. Same time, I think that the diversification of markets and commercial partners around the hemisphere, leaving aside the emerging security partnerships between countries like Venezuela and Iran or Belarus and others, just commercially, it seems to me possible to suggest that the United States has become less important to the hemisphere, even as the hemisphere commercially has become more important for the United States. I think that actually the statistics bear that out. I think in fact, the whole issue does warrant more attention, and that we need to understand more profoundly the degree to which our own future is tied to that of the hemisphere. And it's not just as happens periodically in election seasons, a matter of immigration or even drug trafficking, et cetera. It's commerce, it's energy. There are some very positive initiatives out there, particularly for our own cooperation with the free trade partners that we have within the Americas and working with them for developing the Pacific Rim. But as we concentrate on those, we may very well see the hemisphere becoming more divided.
Let me say, this is and will always be a damned if you do, damned if you don't proposal of our intervention, as it's called sometimes, and our help in others with Latin America. But also, I think it's worth mentioning the current leadership vacuum at the OAS, which is supposed to be our representative there in the region, that they were actually insistent upon sending election observers to the unconstitutional election in Honduras, the Cuarta Urnas. Some of you will recall, but since then I've hardly seen them want to send a delegation anywhere.
So I guess we agree the policy needs some work, to say the least. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Wait for the mic. Let me ask you to ask, if you can, a quick question, because I want to get one or two more in.
Yes, certainly. My name is Philip French. I'm with the American Committees on Foreign Relations, former Foreign Service officer, and I'd like to direct a question to my former boss, Ambassador Duddy. In the piece you wrote for CFR, you referenced earlier today, one of the outcomes you mentioned was if there's a fairly large win by Chavez, that perhaps the United States should relook at the relationship. I think 10% would probably count, certainly would here. So my question then is, would you expand on what relooking at the relationship would be? Thanks.
What I'd say very briefly is, I did in fact emphasize that if the election were deemed free and fair, it certainly seems to have been deemed largely free. There's a question hanging in the air, I think, in the policy community in Washington as to how fair it was. That said, we still don't have a Senate-confirmed ambassador in Venezuela. Do I think that we should move quickly to fill that position? I'm not convinced one way or the other. But it's giving thought to the question of whether the bilateral relationship, recognizing that we have interests, security interests, which are becoming increasingly acute, but also commercial interests, I think is good and sufficient reason for some of our former colleagues, since you and I are both, as is Ray, all retired Foreign Service officers, for some of our former colleagues, I'm still engaged in these matters, to sit down and say, okay, where do we go? What's worked? What hasn't? Coming back to John's comment on what the United States might do, we have in fact sanctioned Venezuela in a whole series of ways, but we have done so seemingly in ways that have had relatively little impact on Venezuela's behavior, and we have been, I think, as a government, reluctant to ratchet up that pressure. I'm not suggesting that we need to. I am suggesting that we need to recognize that we have interests. We have more robust relations with others in the world with whom we also have difficulties. What's the right sort of formulation for a relationship with Venezuela? Hard to say, because it's something that requires some response also from Venezuela. And I don't think that we need to be petitioners to Venezuela. They are an important player in the hemisphere. They are a trading partner, but they aren't. We've learned to live with the current situation. We need to give some study on how to improve it from our own point of view.
One last quick question, if anybody has one. All right, then I am going to conclude this session. I want to thank all of you for coming.
There is a question.
Okay, sorry. I didn't see the hand. Getting old.
Evan Ellis, Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies, National Defense University. My question, and my apologies, I arrived late, and so you may have already addressed this, but given that the strategy of Capriles was very different than what we saw from Manuel Rosales in the previous presidential election, and given that Rosales was very different than the strategy of boycotting the congressional elections, now that we have this attempt to win by being almost as Chavista as Chavez, what does the result of the election do to the strategy and the behavior of the opposition now as we move forward into this next six-year period?
That's a big question, but let me ask for concise answers, all right, in the interest of time.
Ivan, welcome. I'm not sure that the strategy, Capriles' strategy, was so different from Rosales's. The fact is that Capriles is a much more attractive political figure than Rosales. He's younger. He wasn't tainted by the past. Rosales had been governor of Zulia, and there were shady situations there. He is a much better candidate. Now, the second part of your question concerning what next for the opposition. I understand they are making a huge effort to prevent the opposition electorate from becoming demoralized, because after all, a defeat is a defeat. This hurt a lot, because there were many people hoping that this time we were going to win. I understand that they are making a huge organizational effort to make sure that the key governorships that are currently in the hands of the opposition will remain so, and that perhaps we will be able to win one or two extra ones. Now, concerning the elections in April for the municipal council, there is an interesting fact there. The results of the October the 7th elections showed two things. Capriles visited, I think we have 350 municipalities around that number. He visited 300 of them. Perhaps I'm exaggerating a little bit. And the results were not at all up to the expectations, because most of these municipalities belong to the rural part of the country, where dependency on the government is much stronger, and it is not, they are not worth the tremendous effort that was put into them. I think they will concentrate, both for the region, for the gubernatorial and municipal elections, on the big urban centers, and that I think is the right idea.
So hang on for round two and three. On behalf of Ambassador Darren Bloom and Hudson Institute, I want to thank the Lyon and Harry Bradley Foundation for their support of this series and this panel. Thank you all for participating, and I want to thank, join me in thanking the panelists for contributing here.